Welcome to Environment Deep Dive, a series from the Civil Service Environment Network. Through this series, we aim to explain and explore the biggest issues in environmental policy, talking to experts on topics across climate change, sustainable development, natural resources, and biodiversity and ecosystems.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Civil Service Climate and Environment Network Deep Dive podcast. I'm Nancy Clark from the Civil Service Climate and Environment Network, and today we will be exploring the really interesting and critical area of global conservation. I'm really happy to be joined by Joanne Elliott from Fauna and Flora International, who is going to share with us more information about her highly impactful work and the organisation's impactful work concerning conservation globally. So, hi Jo, and thank you so much for being our expert guest today. We're really happy to have you with us.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Nancy.
We would like to really start by getting to know you a little bit more. So, really, we'd like you to tell us first a little bit more about what your role is at Fauna and Flora International, and how did you get there?
Okay, So just a quick introduction. Fauna and Flora is the UK's oldest international conservation charity. We work at local level, which is the critical thing I'll probably need to talk to you about and that you'll want to hear about, across sort of 40 countries and so on. My role, we have a large global programme that's working with partner organisations locally across all these countries. My role, along with two colleagues, is to lead that program, that global program. I'll let you know my background because that helps you see what role I have. I'm an economist. So my background is very much economics, finance and business, a lot of my early career was in banking and then management consulting. I used to work for the Boston Consulting Group. And very much brought sort of a management consulting and business background into conservation about 25 years ago. So my role within most of my colleagues at Fauna and Flora are scientists, a lot of ecologists, but a very broadly based set of scientists, a lot of social scientists as well, as we can explore, if that's helpful. And my role really is on the business side, is looking at, we've got a number of programs working with the private sector, working with the sort of the business canvas, if you like, at local level and how to make that work for conservation, and the social safeguards and all that goes with working with IPLC groups across the world. So I manage the part of the program that is really looking out into the private sector and how companies and financial institutions engage with conservation. And I also manage the Africa program. I spent a long time living in Africa, working across sub-Saharan Africa on building big conservation programs. So
wow,
that's a quick intro.
Oh, no, well, it sounds immensely interesting. And I think there's so much more focus perhaps now than there had been previously on nature finance and natural capital. So we can maybe dig into that a little bit later about, you know, your thoughts around where things need to go and how well they are going. It's a fascinating and critical area, I think. So, but just to try and get a little bit more familiar with you, I mean, certainly, You work on an area that's really close to your heart, and you know it's interesting to try and find out what, you know, work and passion and hobbies. Like, do you get any time to ever do anything that's a hobby related, or you know, are your hobbies relating to the work you do? Or
I mean it's a pretty full-time occupation. I kind of dream my work as well, but I'm not boring, I hope. I think what I do, it's interesting because when you're working on nature, anyone who has a passion for nature anyway, which is most people I know, you know, my hobbies are walking and, you know, being out in nature and, you know, I'm a diver. I've been lucky enough to live in lots of really interesting places. And so my holidays tend to be also about immersing myself in nature as well. What do I do? Actually, to relax, I play board games. There you go. My day-to-day work is very brain heavy. It's very analytically intensive. And I find it very relaxing. The trouble is I need other people to play it with. So I have to go and drag a few people in to do that. But yeah, aww, that's me.
And it's interesting you said you've lived in lots of interesting places. And I wondered if you have a favourite or a particular part of the world, an area, you know, a natural area that's your standout favourite and why that might
be. Well, I'm very lucky. I've been to a lot of I've been to some of the world's most beautiful places. I mean, I know there are some I haven't been to, but I lived in Indonesia for a long time and, you know, love the eastern islands of Indonesia are just beautiful, and the marine environment particularly. But then I've been working on Africa, on Eastern Africa, particularly Kenya. I lived in Nairobi for 5 years. That's where my kids were born as well. And I have an absolute, so I get back to Nairobi and breathe in and it's coming home. So, yeah.
Wow. Well, thank you. That just must be a really interesting sense that, you know, the work that you're doing is actually helping ensure some of these beautiful places are being, you know, we're doing what we need to do now to try and protect them.
I'm a lot more fervent than that now. For me, it's not about the beautiful areas, it's really about local people being included as part of the, you know, the interesting thing for me about conservation, having been in the sector for so long, is seeing the way it kind of it's paradigms that come back and then separate and then come back again. When I first worked in conservation, there was a real sense of us having to kind of beat down the doors of fortress conservation, you know, keeping people out of protected areas and, you know, how this was a global public good, you know, that needed to be preserved rather than actively managed and conserved. And it was very interesting all through the sort of 90s and early noughties, really rebuilding that understanding of nature being a key issue in poverty alleviation. So I worked at DFID for a while it was DFID, and did a lot of work on that nature poverty linkage side, including on the policy side of that. Hugely important, incredibly significant, and for me really changed the context for what we were trying to do practically in the field with local partner organisations, which was all, essentially it brought people, it made people come first. If it's not working for local people, then it isn't sustainable conservation. That's how we came to it. And unfortunately, what we've seen in the last few years is a kind of re-separation of the paradigm because of the sense of emergency around nature. There's a real sense now that we haven't got the time that it takes to set up the governance, the institutions, the local organisations that will truly empower and enable locally led conservation. And instead, we need to kind of get in there and urgently protect everything. And I just couldn't disagree more with that approach. So for Fauna and Flora, it is all about locally led everything. If it's not legitimate, and if it doesn't have integrity at local level, whatever you've managed to win in the short term, it will not last. So that's my mission. So
that's absolutely intriguing, because it's, you know, it sounds like what you're saying is the sustainability of any work is based around that fundamental principle of the linkage between nature and poverty and getting how that's accommodated into any policy, and then implementation is critical. In fact, my next question to you was going to be, can you explain the interconnection between economics, livelihoods and nature in lay terms, and how it applies to your work? And obviously there is this discussion, for example, around the Dasgupta Review, natural capital, the UK government talks about public goods and and, you know, biodiversity and nature as a public good. So it'd be really interesting, you know, if there's more to layer on to what you've already shared in that regard.
Yeah, there's a lot there, isn't there? I was a great believer, as an economist, I was a great believer in using environmental economics and being able to quantify non-monetary values as a mechanism for conservation for a decade. I have to say I'm much, much more cynical now. And what I really enjoyed about the Dasgupta review, but probably even more so from those very interesting Mark Carney Reith lectures, that lecture 4 on climate change, for me really tallied well with the Dasgupta review, where they both basically say, don't count on the market. The market is not going to deliver this for us. And in fact, if I'm remembering correctly, both say we're really being let down by the supranational institutional framework for governing global public goods. And we need to do what Fauna and Flora does, work at the local level to really get that legitimacy and, you know, the practical lived out realities of impact on the ground. We need to get that done. We need to replicate that everywhere, but we also need to match it with a supranational governance framework that actually supports the fact that we can't count on the private sector to come in and deliver it. And the big hypothesis at the moment is that the private sector will. And the most fun I have is working with big corporates, trying to get them to live up to their nature positive commitments, which they're all making, and most of them quite legitimately and sincerely want to do that. But the truth is, we cannot price this stuff into success, in my view. In my view, what's really missing at the moment is a sense of corporate philanthropy in the true sense of societal good. What does it mean to be a good citizen as a corporate as well as an individual? And that isn't about just buying some carbon credits. You know, by all means, find legitimate and high integrity carbon credits. We'd be the first organisation to say that's a really useful and important, you know, entry point into the system. But boy, tip of the iceberg, you know, we are not going to save we're not going to save Amazonia. We're not going to save the Central African forests. We're not going to save the Indonesian forests in particular by buying carbon credits. So there's a lot more. Yeah, there's an awful lot more that we need to be doing, and that's what keeps us busy.
Thank you for sharing all of that. And I just wondered if you're able, in terms of Fauna and Flora's International's work, in this.
It's just Fauna and Flora, by the way,
sorry.
Just so you know. You don't need to say International,
sorry.
You dropped it.
Thank you. Obviously working at the local level, are you working with the private sector and governments as well, and what works for you in terms of getting that, or what doesn't work as well in terms of trying to get that to knit together to try and achieve things in the way that you've outlined really needs to be achieved?
So we are working in each place. It works differently. So in some places the big corporates are a threat, and there you have to work in line with, you know, the, depending on who's funding them, with in line with gold standard principles for, you know, corporate performance, for impact assessment, just to mitigate, in line with the mitigation hierarchy. So you're trying to get everyone to reduce the threat, but also you're working with corporates at board level to try and really enable and instill thinking about, you know, the global role in cleaning up supply chains and you know, making sure that what's happening at board level is also translated into impact on the ground. So we do that alongside working particularly, so very, very differently with local and central government in each of the places we're working. So local government for us is often a partner. You know, there's an awful lot of tenure issues, resource use rights issues that are actually under the mandate of local and central government. So you need to be working alongside them with your partner organisations to set up the framework of incentives and user rights to enable change on the ground, to ensure that local people are able to benefit from conservation work through being able to set up businesses, through jobs, through being able to supply foods into a system, through being able to access more efficient supply chains into their end user markets, and then being able to access higher value end user markets as well. And all of that requires a systemic approach. You've got to get the alignment between the reality check on the ground of what partners are wanting to do, the maturity of their institutions, alongside what the policy framework, both at local and central government level, but also just the real practicalities, where there's conflict in every situation, there's always divergence of interests. So you've got to find those mitigation measures. You've got to enable open and transparent conversations to try and solve problems. Sometimes it doesn't work, but we're in the privileged position of actually working in a lot of places where it is working at local level.
And being able to share those stories and help role model that, I imagine, as well.
And bring those local voices of success up to help influence the policy framework, but also to help give a bit more optimism and hope into, the whole environment of, gloom. Climate is weighing heavily on all of us. So trying to integrate, as most of us are aware, nature is both the solution and the potential loss of, climate will cause terrible losses in nature. It's a vicious circle if we don't address both issues hand in hand. And seeing it work at the local level, there's scope for replicating a lot of really good work.
It sounds really positive that you're able to share, and really emphasise the great work that is taking place, that you're aware of, that needs more, as much as possible to be shared and made aware of. It was interesting to actually hear you talk about as well, that's, I'll say climate doom, but obviously there's elements of that more so in the media. You hear about climate anxiety, how the youth of today are trying to deal with what they think their future might look like. And I guess youth and other elements of equality, diversity, inclusion. How do you feel that plays into the work?
There's two very different questions there. So the doom and gloom, I think, is totally legitimate and very understandable. And we all need to recognise that is our reality. And yes, we've either got 10 years or 20 years, depending on exactly which source you use. We have not got long to sort this problem out, and leadership is needed from every government, and particularly from the UK, but let's not go there in this conversation at the moment, or at least I'm happy to, but it's a long story. But the UK traditionally has led on a lot of nature climate work globally, and at the moment we're really missing the UK from that space, so please come back. In terms of, what was your other question? Oh my goodness, it's so important. And interestingly for me, I've worked in this sector for a very long time, and I've worked for the sector outside of the UK. Outside of the UK, this is a pretty diverse and inclusive sector. It's interesting for me that in the UK we see, one of the things that I would like to see is conservation appealing more to a diverse group as a career choice. And it, at the moment, it doesn't seem to so much. And I think there's a lot the conservation sector's got to do to do that. I mean, I don't know if you know, but Fauna and Flora is part of an initiative at Cambridge University called the Cambridge Conservation Initiative. We're in a building with university departments and 9 other international organisations. And that's one of the things we are really driving to see and it's one of the things we're really hoping we will see dramatic change in the next 5 to 10 years is EDI within conservation in the UK.
It's interesting to try and speculate about why it is the way it currently is in the UK.
I think there's a lot of social I think there's a lot of historical issues. I think there is an issue with a sense of Britain's colonial past and it being therefore quite a negative connotation. I think there's, you know, I think it is, I'm afraid in the UK, it's a very low paid sector. So I think for kids with, you know, big student loans and aspirations for, you know, slightly higher material benefits, it's not going to appeal. I think it's improving. It's improving. I mean, it's certainly from a gender point of view, we're seeing, I mean, I actually don't have the statistics of my own, but I'd guess that Fauna and Flora is more than 50% women in our global operations. And a lot of our leaders are women. So that one's cracked.
And actually, it's interesting also then to think about on the ground, some of the on the ground work that's taking place at that level. You know, the associations with gender, for example, and how that plays out there.
Yeah, and that's very country specific and area specific. We've got a lot. So in Africa, I think our five country directors, country leads are all women. They're all African women. So it's, but it's, you know, that it's not deliberate. it's just what we're seeing coming bubbling up through the system. But at field level, particularly people managing large groups of rangers, it is quite a different proposition sometimes. It's harder to break into, but you've probably come across, there are some fantastic women rangers groups in Africa and elsewhere, you know, who are sending women up through the bottom-up system into that kind of more mainstream conservation action. It's changing, but there's more we need to do.
And then continuing the theme of more that we need to do, you obviously talked about the UK's place in the international arena in terms of climate and environment. There are, I don't know if it's just my perception, but the news coverage of events that take place these days seems to be quite strong. There was obviously the UK with COP 26, COP 27's happened, COP 28 is coming up. There's recently been the UN Food Systems Summit in Rome, the second one, recognising more about food systems impact on nature, and also the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services with their invasive alien species assessment just this week. I just think it would be really interesting to understand a bit more about how you feel about the multilateral fora and the impact, and if multilateralism is working and what can help make it work better. And obviously you can go where you would like with that answer.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's all really important. So, you know, so the Paris Agreement has driven change through the multilateral system. And, you know, we measure everything against Paris alignment. You know, we won't work with partners who don't understand where they fit in that scenario. So in that sense, there's been some progress. Of course, the lack of progress is delivering on the commitments. So we've got a long, long way to go, and it needs to happen urgently. What I would say, the weakness I see is we know there is an $800 billion a year gap between what is currently on the table and what is needed to deliver on the Global Biodiversity Framework that was agreed in Montreal last December. And that there have been some really interesting studies, not done by me, but I, you know, that say that essentially at the moment, probably less than 10% of the funds that are available come down to local level. So as an organisation that's really focused on locally led initiatives, and for us, that's where we see the opportunity for sustainability. There needs to be a huge shift in the multilateral framework to emphasise that the money needs to go not to the intermediary consulting firms and private sector project developers and so on. The money, we must be measuring how much money gets into local level impact. And I will credit, if I'm allowed, I'll credit DEFRA here with the fantastic Darwin Initiative, but also the new RADAR program that the International Institute for Environment and Development is delivering. These are all really valuing locally led initiatives and leadership from locally based organisations in a way that is transforming impact on the ground. but it's doing so site by site. So you don't see that added up really into what the impact is that those things are having, but it's fantastic.
Really, thank you for your positive feedback there on DEFRA's work in the, on those schemes and programmes. And in fact, that leads nicely into something I did want to ask as well, which is there's the allocation of the money where it needs to be and how well that is utilised, and then ensuring that it's having the right impact. And there are all these questions around how we really can get a grip on how we measure in order to demonstrate the impact. So I think, you know, your thoughts about where we're at with, you know, there's one thing measuring carbon, and there's a whole other thing measuring biodiversity and ecosystems and more broadly.
Well, funny you should ask that question. It is taking up an awful lot of our sector's thinking. There's no single measure of biodiversity. Sorry. Everyone wants there to be. There's real risks in seeking one. So that's something we're acutely aware of. Clearly, one of the critical things to come out of the Global Biodiversity Framework is this commitment to 30 by 30, which the UK has bought into. And, you know, our mission there is twofold. One is to make sure that's about quality. It's not about area under management. It must be effectiveness. We've all seen barren fields. You know, they cannot be included as our contribution to biodiversity globally. There must be some sense in which things are actually being well managed for biodiversity. But the other thing is, in seeking a single measure, which we won't find, we're seeing this at the moment in the development of the biodiversity credit space, which we're working hard at with a lot of others. Actually, the risk of seeking that single unifying metric is that you're not looking at the local level. So local people measure really different things in terms of how they value, what they value, how they are going to benefit from healthy nature, healthy biodiversity. We must take that into account. So as we start aggregating, we need to make sure we are doing so in a way that still holds respect for the integrity of the local measurement of impact. And that's something Fauna and Flora is working really hard at. We haven't got the answer yet, but we're really trying to ensure that there is this legitimacy and integrity in all of these initiatives. So we've been working on it within the climate carbon markets for a long time, but we're now trying to make sure that the biodiversity credit markets learn from a lot of the lessons that are coming out of how we measure the effectiveness for nature on the carbon credit side, which has been very, very mixed, as I'm sure many of you and your colleagues are well aware.
Yes, we have lots of economists and scientists in government who are constantly working on this area as well. So it's really valuable to have your insights and heartening to know, you know, how much work is going on this externally as well. So we're reaching the end of our time together, but I you know, a final question was really about a call to action. You know, we want to ask you, what message would you like to send to the government and the civil service?
Okay, well, I mean, so fortunately for me, I work only on global issues. I'm not working in the UK. So, but what I can say is the UK in the past on global issues has been an absolute leader. So for most of my career, I have been very proud to be, you know, associated with Britain as I go through trying to build the global framework for addressing nature, poverty and climate linkages. I have to say at the moment that is not the case. And I would just, you know, I've worked with lots of civil servants, I think, who are brilliant, and a lot of ministers who at the time have all felt they were trying to do the right thing. But there's something in our joined up government approach to leading on these issues at the moment that is lacking. So I would just say, bring back global leadership of global nature, climate and poverty issues, please, because we need it. It's definitely missing at the moment. In fairness to the UK, it's missing from we've gone bilateral, and the multilateral framework is not supporting us sufficiently at the moment. So we need more of the joined up conversations at government, you know, that just bring that recognise what's being brought to us globally by the scientists of the IPCC and of IPBES. They're saying it needs to happen, and it needs to happen within the next 5 to 10 years. We need to see systemic change. Be brave, you know, help explain to all your taxpayers and voters that, you know, these are voting issues that you're willing to respond to. And, you know, let's start creating a real base for hope and optimism.
Thank you so much. It's been so interesting. I would like to be able to ask you lots more questions over a lot more time. Thank you immensely. I just want to say thank you, obviously, on behalf of the overall Civil Service Climate and Environment Network as well, all of its members, because I think they're really going to enjoy listening to everything that you've shared with us here today. You've given us so much insight and things to think about in terms of, well, how we measure what we're doing, the financial flows, where multilateralism needs to work in a more optimal way. And I just really, really do want to thank you so much for joining us. And also I would like to thank everyone for listening today. So thank you.
No, thank you. Thank you. It was a pleasure. Keep in touch.
Will do.
We're very happy. We work very closely with a lot of, particularly with DEFRA. So yeah, come and talk to us.
We hope you've enjoyed this Environment Deep Dive. You can head to CSUN online for more content, events and networking opportunities. Make sure to subscribe to us on Twitter, YouTube and your favourite podcast app so you can keep an eye out for new episodes coming soon.